Herr Professor Mattes, Herr Professor Nauck, Herr Staatssekretär Inze, sehr geehrter Herr Ministerpräsident Tillich, Professor Viriat Sulmani-Marques, Professor Teresa Pinheiro, haben Sie ganz herzlichen Dank für Ihre sehr freundlichen Worte. Es ist mir eine große Ehre, heute von Ihnen die Ehrendoktorwürde, glauben Sie wie mir, ich habe lange trainiert für dieses Wort, es ist mir eine große Ehre, heute von Ihnen die Ehrendoktorwürde der Technischen Universität Chemnitz zu erhalten. Genauso freue ich mich, nun zu Ihnen, zu so vielen herausragenden Akademikern über europäische Identität zu sprechen. Und erlauben Sie mir bitte auch eine persönliche Bemerkung. Ich freue mich natürlich sehr über die enge Zusammenarbeit zwischen der Technischen Universität Chemnitz und meiner Alma Mater, der Universität Lissabon. Diese Debatte in Chemnitz zu führen, kann ich nur begrüßen. Wir sind hier im Herzen der deutschen Einheit und der erweiterten Europäischen Union. Und dies wenige Tage vor dem 5. Jahrestag der Erweiterung der EU. Diese Erweiterung war aber weit mehr als nur eine einfache Vergrößerung der EU. Sie war die Wiedervereinigung Europas, die erzwungene Teilung Europas in zwei Teile durch den Eisernen Vorhang ist endgültig überwunden für Deutschland und Europa. Oder wie Helmut Kohl sagte, die deutsche und die europäische Einheit sind die zwei Seiten ein und derselben Medaille. Meine Damen und Herren, wir begehen heute mit dem 8. Mai einen ganz besonderen Tag im gemeinsamen Gedächtnis Europas. Für viele Europäer und zum Glück auch für viele Deutsche markiert dieses Datum das Ende von Krieg und Diktatur und den Beginn von Freiheit und Demokratie. Für viele andere Europäer jedoch, darunter auch für die Deutschen aus diesem Teil Deutschlands, war es das Ende von einer Diktatur und der Beginn der nächsten. Zwar das Ende von Krieg, aber die Fortsetzung der Unfreiheit. Die Menschen in Mittel- und Osteuropa mussten fast ein halbes Jahrhundert länger als die Menschen im Westen auf ihre Freiheit warten oder für sie kämpfen. Die Hoffnung auf ein vereintes und freies Europa haben sie in dieser langen Zeit nicht aufgegeben. Viele haben dafür einen hohen Preis, viel zu viele mit ihrem eigenen Leben bezahlt. Die Überzeugung, der Glaube an ein gemeinsames, vereintes Europa hat am Ende gezeigt, ob in Deutschland, Polen, Ungarn, der Tschechoslowakei, Baltikum oder Rumänien. Überall hatten die Menschen denselben Drang nach Freiheit und Demokratie, nach einem gemeinsamen Europa. Ich möchte den Menschen meinen großen Dank und meinen tiefen Respekt für ihren Mut und ihre Beharrlichkeit aussprechen. Meine Damen und Herren, ich möchte Ihre Geduld mit mir nicht zu sehr auf die Probe stellen. Bitte erlauben Sie mir deshalb nun auf Englisch fortzufahren. Dear colleagues of the Chemnitz University, dear student, I have been asked today to consider the question of European identity in relation to global challenges. The nature of these challenges is obvious. The first economic crisis of the age of globalization, increased competition with Europe, namely from great emerging economic powers like China and India, and the emergence of truly global problems such as climate change and energy security. But what do these challenges mean for European identity? Well, to put it crudely, they make it more necessary. Global challenges mean that it is more important than ever for Europe to behave as one entity, to act together, and make its voice heard on the world stage. But this will only happen if we can develop a stronger sense of our common European identity. And we should also see it from the other angle. The more convincing and united European action to face global challenges, the stronger European identity will become over time. So what might this identity be? What kind of identity does Europe need to develop in the global age? I believe that it must be an identity based around our shared values. And I like to underline the word values. Of course, there are common interests, but the true identity has to be based on common values and shared values. Values such as freedom, peace, the rule of law, respect for human rights, respect for diversity, principle of solidarity and tolerance. Let me stress briefly the value of tolerance. Some argue that tolerance was invented in Europe. Admittedly, there was a great deal of religious persecution in medieval Europe. But there were examples of tolerance too. And by the 17th century in Europe, there was a serious and very important body of writing on this subject. We need to build on this heritage now, because one of the changes brought by globalization is the mass movement of people around the world. Europe is now a society made up of people of many different cultures, traditions, faiths, and convictions. European identity must embrace this reality and be inclusive, not exclusive. Indeed, it is perhaps time to move beyond tolerance towards an even more robust appreciation of the value of pluralism and diversity in our society. Goethe said, "To merely tolerate is an insult. True liberalism means acceptance." He was right. But of course, the notion of mutual acceptance implies that acknowledgement of each other's difference and dignity always goes both ways. Globalization also means that we must reassess our attitude to and our relationship with the rest of the world. In Europe, some people fear globalization. They believe that it will lead to a dilution or even the disappearance of their culture or their identity. I do not. I am certain that globalization will benefit us not just economically, because Europe is the first economic power globally and the first trading power globally, but culturally too. Because globalization, it's indeed the opportunity for exchanges, for appreciation of the diversity of cultures. I think Europe needs to be confident on its own identity, confident enough to be open to outside influences, confident enough to promote values internationally without wishing to impose them on others, as I very often say, to propose, not to impose our values. But in fact, the big cultural question is a choice of paradigm. In the world of globalization, are we going to follow an open paradigm, or are we going to close ourselves? Are we going to try to reinforce a kind of egocentric, closed notion of identity, of chauvinism, or are we going to affirm our identity, to affirm our values, but in dialogue with others? So building an identity that is not a negation of other identities. I think we need to consolidate this strong positive identity based on what we are for and not on the rejection of others. Too often, identities are forged in opposition to the identity of others. I believe we should avoid this. At the same time, we should recognize that we have a distinctive contribution to make to the world. Yes, we can be proud of our traditions, of our civilization, of our values. While many of our values may not be unique to us, some of them are, or at least they are more prevalent here than they are elsewhere. And in fact, some of those values, based in very ancient historic traditions, from Greek and classic Rome to Christianity to the Renaissance, some of them were specially developed after the Second World War, not only with the European integration process, but also with the creation of what we call here in Germany the social market economy, what some people now call the Modèle Social Européen. So a combination of openness with a willingness for strong social and economic cohesion. This is typically a European model. I believe that in Europe, more than in other parts of the world, we attach more value to solidarity and we are much more aware of the importance of environmental issues. This is part of our contribution to today's world. But also we have something that is very important, is our love of freedom. Freedom in politics, in the economy, and in life. Let me just now share with you an experience I had yesterday in Prague. I just came from Prague. I spent all my week in Prague. By the way, during the week, I got the news of the approval by the Senate of the Lisbon Treaty. But I was there also to follow that. But not only. I was there for several summits, a summit with Canada, a summit, an employment summit, a summit that happened today on the Southern Corridor of Energy, but also a very important historic summit where Chancellor Merkel also participated, distance summit for our new relation and partnership with the countries at the east of the European Union. And at dinner, I had the privilege to be in a table with President Klaus of Czech Republic, President Gül of Turkey, President Aliyev of Azerbaijan, Prime Minister Reinfeldt of Sweden, next president of the Council. And the most impressive was to listen President Klaus and President Aliyev telling me how it was in the Soviet times or in totalitarian times, how many years they had to fight to get a passport to leave their country, how many years they took and influenced to have the opportunity to go out of their countries and to visit what was called the West. Some days ago, in Warsaw, Prime Minister Tusk told me he waited 17 years for a visa to go for the first time to Paris with his wife. So the basic human freedoms, the freedom to travel, freedom to move, they were not possible in Europe very recently, in this part of Europe where we are here in the former Karl Marx Stadt. This was not possible. That's why I cannot be pessimistic about Europe. I have a great confidence in the value of freedom because this generation still remembers that. My generation in my own country remembered when we could not read the books we wanted. That's why some of us became Marxists, because the regime did not allow us to read those books at that time. My generation had not the possibility to have the access to some of the cultural goods. And now, the generation of yours has this great, great advantage. I cannot be pessimistic. I know that sometimes, that's what I call the Hammurabi complex, the generations believe that the next one is worse. I say the Hammurabi complex because in the Babylonia, in the Hammurabi stone, they were saying already, this new generation does not know how to behave, they don't respect the family, they don't respect the values. So almost all generations believe that next one is not up to the job. I believe that your generation has that great experience of freedom. But it is because of that that we have to put in perspective where we come from. And these are the European values. These values have given the opportunity for a unique economic and social model in Europe. And that model was established here in Europe after the Second World War, precisely to avoid extremism. The idea to have a market, an open market, but the idea to have it with some important level of social inclusion with welfare state. This was, to a large extent, a German creation after the World War. And let's be frank, this was also the result of the contribution of different political families, the Christian Democrats here in Germany and in Italy, but also the Social Democrats in Scandinavia or the labor movement in Britain, precisely to avoid what Europe has known under fascism or Nazism, or to avoid totalitarian communism. There was this movement to create this idea of freedom with a social commitment. I believe this is the model for the 21st century. I believe that others are now looking at Europe as a great source of inspiration in this new age of globalization. This crisis is showing that the market without rules, the market without a social commitment is not what the people want. But this crisis also shows that the solution is not to go back to the solutions of full state intervention and control by the state of the freedoms of our human beings. This is why I believe Europe can be an example for the rest of the world. There was in Europe, in cultural matters, always this great interest for this combination. And today I can tell that in Europe we are, precisely because we are open to others, we are in a position to make some influence on those developments. Other countries in the world, for instance in Latin America, are looking to our model of development. Our standards and rules are often adopted in other parts of the world, including now, in some economic matters, in China, apart from Japan. Europe must build on its immense advantage when it comes to transnational regulatory cooperation or even integration. This is why international interest in the European model will increase in the wake of the crisis as people become more aware of the need for a sustainable way of life. The G20 process, which was launched on the European Union's initiative, clearly demonstrates this, the need for global governance, the need that to accept some rules. And there is not any other part of the world with that experience of setting and creating supranational, transnational rules and also supranational institutions that has developed that capacity so much as we have done in the European Union. It only remains now for the people of Europe to be inspired by the European dream and for us to be sufficiently cohesive to make our voice heard. We need, therefore, to continue to promote a common European identity, and I have long believed that culture has a key role to play. Culture is, after all, immensely powerful. Just look at the way in which autocratic and totalitarian regimes have always persecuted artists, writers, and creators. Of course, the great challenge to Europeans is to find the correct balance between a common identity and cultural diversity. We can look at European history to find extraordinary examples of such a balance. Georg Steiner summarizes cultural diversity neatly in his essay on the idea of Europe. And he says, "The genius of Europe is what William Blake would have called the holiness of the minute particular. It is that of linguistic, cultural, social diversity, of a prodigal mosaic, which often makes a trivial distance, 20 kilometers apart, a division between worlds. We must cherish our cultural diversity and protect it. That is one of the major purposes of the European Union. Here also, we have to apply the principle of subsidiarity. It means that we have shared common goals, but that we respect this diversity, including in the cultural sphere. At the same time, we should, of course, remember and reinforce what we have in common. Given the venue for this talk, for example, it is perhaps appropriate to remember that in the Middle Ages, scholars from all nations gathered to study universities in Latin. There are even hostels or houses of different peoples in the oldest European universities, such as the Collegio di Spagna, a college for Spanish students at the University of Bologna. And we should remember that the great artistic and cultural movements have rarely been confined to a single country. I'm thinking of the monks who ensured that Gothic architecture spread to all corners of Europe, from Paris to Milan, Salisbury to Cologne, and Lisbon to Krakow. Or of the fine examples of Renaissance architecture to be seen outside of Italy, such as the Chateau of la Loire, Hardwick Hall in England, and New Cloth Hall in Krakow. And one must not forget the magnificent gifts of Baroque art to be seen and admired all over Europe, in Rome and St. Petersburg, in Berlin and Paris, in Stockholm and Vienna, and of course, a few kilometers from here, in your beautiful capital of Saxony, in Dresden. Or of the grand tours undertaken by young Europeans in the 17th and 18th centuries, or the Wanderjahre of a young man like Albrecht Dürer, learning skills from artists in other countries, a tradition which Goethe was still writing about nearly three centuries later, or William Wordsworth's walking tour of Europe, during which he covered vast distances, visiting France, Switzerland, and Italy. I'm thinking how Art Nouveau spread to cities as far apart as Prague, Glasgow, Barcelona, Vienna, Riga, Helsinki, and Brussels, close to the headquarters of the European Commission, and of how Paris, at the beginning of the last century, became home to Picasso, Gris, Brancusi, Giacometti, Julio González, and so many other great artists and sculptors from different countries. Some will say that this is the culture of the elite, and that it is therefore largely irrelevant. I do not agree. I believe in the great, powerful force of culture. I believe, and I've said it very often, that in the hierarchy of values, culture comes before politics. Politics is instrumental. Politics is a way for us to create the conditions for people, for individual citizens, for human being, for a man or a woman to fulfill their dreams, to realize their dreams. And their dreams are in the private sphere, love and friendship. In the public sphere, they are the creation and the discovery or the invention. That's why I really believe that we have to invest more in Europe in culture in the broader sense, culture and science. And that's why I really believe that universities, and I'm very happy to be today in such a university like yours, we have a special role to promote that Europe of education and research. And I'm very proud of the developments that recently we had in Europe through the European Research Council, European Institute of Innovation and Technology, and everything that contributes to create progressively a European space for innovation, culture, research, and education, what we call the fifth freedom, the freedom of circulation of research. But we must also, at the same time we look to the future, have this sense of history. I do not mean some kind of homogenizing, sanitized narrative, the logic of which leads inevitably to very simplistic explanations. What I'm talking about is an honest history, which does not hide the wrinkles, and which promotes some kind of common understanding. Just before his death, great European politician and thinker from Poland, Bronisław Geremek, said that it is far easier to integrate economies and administrations than to unite memories. He was concerned that old and new member states had different understandings of history, and that this might cause problems. Well, of course, we cannot unite memories. Our experience of the past, or at least the recent past, are sometimes different, and we should recognize this. But I think that Geremek would have wanted us to try to understand each other's point of view, and I believe that this is what we can and should do. Ladies and gentlemen, today I have sketched out the kind of European identity that I would like to see emerging, and which I believe will allow us to flourish in the global age. An identity based on shared values, an identity that is open and inclusive, a strong positive identity which will give us the confidence to be open to the world and to make our unique contribution to it, an identity which celebrates our diversity while recognizing our common heritage, a multi-layer identity which allows you to be a proud citizen of Chemnitz but also to feel a citizen of Dresden once you are in Berlin, an identity which makes you feel German when you are traveling through Italy or Ireland, but which also makes you aware of our common values and our way of life, when you are walking with other Europeans along the Great Wall of China. And I mentioned the Great Wall of China because I had a very interesting experience when there was that debate around the European Constitution. Maybe some of you have followed about having or not in the Constitution a reference to the European symbols, the anthem and the European flag. Some politicians argued that those symbols should not be in the constitutional treaty because they were giving the example that we were a state. So some European politicians did not want to have European symbols, the European flag in the constitutional treaty. I can tell that at the same one of these days, I was precisely visiting ASEAN, and I was in Vietnam and in Indonesia. And I can tell you that when they received me as president of the European Commission, they always put the European flag and they always sing the European anthem. So in Asia, they recognize the European identity. I hope that Europeans also are able to recognize it. I can tell you and can add that all the European ambassadors present, they also stood up when there was that European anthem and there was European flag. So it's true that our European identity compared to national identities is relatively fluid or indeterminate. It is not something that can easily or definitively be pinned down. It cannot perhaps be defined only or mainly in terms of the past, but is rather an identity à venir, an identity to come. The Spanish philosopher José Ortega y Gasset put it beautifully when he spoke in Munich in 1953. He said, "European culture is a perpetual creation. It is not a fixed point, but a road which requires us to keep walking." I like this idea, to keep walking. It's a very old European idea from the idea of travel, the idea of Ulysses. The idea that we should keep walking, the journey itself is the end. Our journey is in itself an experience. Of course, those who take decisions politically, they have a special role to play. But so do artists and writers and academics and intellectuals and students like yourselves. So let's join hands and keep walking down the road together. And to conclude, allow me to personal remark to say how deeply moved I am now to be here in Chemnitz, to recognize among those who are here some of my compatriots, like one of the greatest thinkers in Portugal, Professor Eduardo Lourenço, someone who has written about Europe the most beautiful texts in Portuguese you can write about the melancholy of Europe. The idea to combine, when you speak about Europe, reason with passion. And this is the way we have to see Europe. And let me tell that in current times, when I see in those some of the European debates, I see so many things that are false said about Europe. Of course, we are not perfect in Europe and our European institutions. We can always correct. But one thing is to have some different views. Another thing is to falsify the data, not to have a serious intellectual debate. Sometimes when I see some populistic politicians say some things about Europe that are simply not true, I wonder if it is because of bad faith or of ignorance. I think that probably it's because of the two. But I think there is a great responsibility for all those that believe in these ideals to stand for Europe today, to have the courage to say no to the populism, to the extremists, to those that don't accept the importance of this great process of peace and this great project of freedom and solidarity that Europe means. That's why I want to tell you today how honored and pleased I am. I want once again to say, danke schön, thank you very much for this distinction. Please, State Secretary, convey to the Chancellor also my warmest regards, my respect. I really appreciate the words that on behalf of the Chancellor and the federal government we express to you, Mr. Rector, to the academic community here, professors and students. Let me conclude by saying this great travel of Europe, diese Reise mag unendlich sein, aber ich bin sicher, sie wird sich unendlich lohnen. Haben Sie vielen Dank.